movies and musicals with Aideen Gormley on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.
Michael Giacchino, you are very welcome. Thank you so much for talking to us today. You're talking to us from your studio in LA. Could I ask you firstly to describe your surroundings, both technically and also I understand you've some interesting film memorabilia around you there.
Yeah, I do. I try to keep my office as simple as possible when it comes to technology. So I have pretty much only exactly what I need, and I'm not the kind of studio that has racks and racks of equipment. I like things simple. And in fact, if you were to see my room, it really looks like a sort of a jungle outpost. I don't know if you've ever been to Disneyland, but the Jungle Cruise.
Yes.
It's kind of like the Jungle Cruise building. Okay. It's a lot like that. and it's surrounded by all the things that I kind of grew up with. I have all my old toys in here, all the things that I had since I was a kid. It's got stuff from the different projects I've worked on. I have, the speedometer from young Kirk's car from the first Star Trek. I have the Virgin Mary from Lost, and, you know, lots of things like that from across the projects. So it's really just a place that it's kind of an extension of my childhood, this place. It's the equivalent of the basement I used to play in every day when I would go down and make movies and play with all my toys when I was 9 years old. So it's kind of hasn't changed that much.
Well, it's a lovely picture you paint. You mentioned your childhood and your interest in film, which began at such a young age. I'm interested to know, Michael, about those early films that you watched as a kid that had an effect on you, and at what point you started to notice the music.
I think, you know, as a kid, one of my favorite things was on Saturdays, you know, when we had no school, at around 1 o'clock or 1:30, there was a show where I grew up in southern New Jersey, just outside of Philadelphia, called Creature Double Feature. So I would watch all these old monster movies, and the ones that really captured my imagination sort of the most at that age, and we're talking, you know, 7, 8 years old, were the Ray Harryhausen films, you know, where he did all of these amazing visual effects through stop motion, through rear camera projection, all kinds of things like that. And I was amazed to see, hey, how did he get that Cyclops to actually, like, walk across that beach and go after those guys? And how did all these monsters come to life? So I was fascinated at an early age, first with just the filmmaking of it. How did they do that? I loved visual effects. And then I started really getting into music and listening to what was going on behind the scenes. And in those particular movies, you know, there were a few Ray Harryhausen films that were scored by Bernard Herrmann, have these incredible scores. And so I would listen to this music and I would try to find ways to find it as a kid. But it wasn't really until like Close Encounters and Star Wars and Superman and, you know, the late 70s where I was actually started to collect soundtracks. You know, my parents then knew that I loved it, and they would buy them for me, and I would just sit endlessly for hours and hours and hours up in my bedroom listening to these scores. And in addition to that, anytime I went to the movie theater, I would record the movie. I would sneak a tape recorder in, record the movie, and record the whole film. And then at night, that's what I would listen to when I was going to bed. I would listen to the tapes of these films, whether it would be Empire Strikes Back or Raiders of the Lost Ark or really anything. I mean, and it wasn't just movies either. I mean, I've recorded hours and hours of television as well. You know, Muppet Show episodes. The Muppets were a huge influence on everything I've done in my life. I mean, I was obsessed with the Muppets.
I'm just picturing you in the cinema with your tape recorder. It's a great
Yeah. Yeah, I had this I had a semi, you know, it wasn't a tiny tape recorder because in those days there was no such thing, but I had to, you know, hide it under my jacket or whatever, and I would just go in and record it. And it's funny because you can hear, you know, the people laughing, the audience reactions and all of that. But I think for me it was more about just reliving the film, because the only way to relive a film back then was to actually go to the theater and see it. It wasn't immediately available online or DVD. Those things didn't exist. So it was a way that I could relive the film when it was no longer in theaters.
Getting your big break, well, it started certainly with scoring video games. You took a job in Disney's video game division, and this is where you caught the attention of one Steven Spielberg. This is a guy whose attention you want to catch. Can you bring us back to that meeting?
Yeah, you know, that was an interesting time because, you know, I had started out in publicity and marketing at Disney and eventually found my way into the interactive department where I started producing video games for them. And shortly, you know, I was there for a couple of years before moving over to DreamWorks. DreamWorks had just started up. And, of course, Jeffrey Katzenberg, who was at Disney, had left to go and start DreamWorks with David Geffen and Steven Spielberg. So they needed people, like, pretty quickly, because they wanted to ramp up and get things going. And not only were they going to make movies, they wanted to make TV shows, they wanted to do television, cartoons, they wanted to make video games. That was the whole thing. So I ended up over there as a video game producer. And as I was working on the games, you know, friends of mine knew that I wrote music, so I had written some music for some of the Disney video games, some small things. But it wasn't until we were at DreamWorks working on a game called The Lost World, which was based on the film at the time, of course, that Steven was directing simultaneously as we were working on the game, when I got a call from the producer of The Lost World game saying, hey, we have a meeting with Steven tomorrow, and we could really use some music for this animation we're going to show him. Can you write something original that we can put behind it? So I thought, sure, I'll do that. And, you know, it was not a big deal. I went home and I recorded this thing and I handed it to him the next morning and then went about my day. And a few hours later, I got a phone call from Patrick Gilmore, who was the producer of that game. And he was saying, Steven would like you to come down and talk to him. Do you have a second? And I, you know, my first response, because I was so ensconced in what I was doing that day, was, Steven who? You know, I was like, who? I don't have time for this. And he was like, it's Steven Spielberg, our boss. And I was like, oh, yeah. That I can do for sure. So I headed down stairs and he was there waiting for me. And he, you know, shook my hand and said, I just want to tell you, I love the music that you did for the animation there. And, you know, what are your plans for the rest of the game? And will you be scoring the whole game? And will, you know, and, I, you know, all of this was like, I had no idea that this was going to happen, and I certainly didn't have plans to score the whole game yet. I was still working on my own stuff, but it sort of catapulted me into an area that I had been wanting to get into for a long time. And the words out of his mouth that really changed everything for me were when he said, and we're going to record this with a live orchestra, right? It's, you know, expensive to record with a live orchestra, but, you know, for me, it makes a huge difference between, you know, synth and live, and I will always go live all the time. So when he said that, that sort of set my life on a whole different path. And from then on, all I've been doing is live orchestral recordings. And I love working with the musicians. You know, you get to meet and work with the most talented musicians you've ever seen in your life. They're incredible. So
you have some favorites that you tend to work with a lot, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I have a large team of people in the as far as the orchestra goes, because the orchestra can be up to, you know, 100, 111 people, depending on the film. You know, it ranges anywhere from 50 to 100, like I said, depending on what the movie is and what it calls for. But generally, it's up around, you know, near 100. So, and there are a lot of those players that I've been working with since day one, you know, some and some of them incredibly famous percussionists like Emil Richards, who did the percussion on the original Planet of the Apes and is responsible for a lot of the sounds you heard in that film.
Wow.
He's worked with me on everything I've ever done and still does. I just finished Coco for Pixar. He worked on that with me. And, you know, it's so great to go through this whole process with this family of musicians and these people that you really get to know, and they're really supportive and incredibly creative, and they always want to try something different. And that's great, because I do too. I don't want every single score I do to sound the same. I look for ways to try different instrumentation, to try different ways to orchestrating, different orchestral sizes, just so that each film sort of feels like its own unique idea.
Yeah, I love that the orchestra is at the heart of what you do, because, you know, there could have been that threat to the orchestra being used with the sort of synthesizers of the 80s, but the orchestra stage, you're such a, you know, you're so brilliant in your orchestrations too. But you're also brilliant at writing melodies, which is something I adore about your scoring. We interviewed the late, great John Barry on this show many years ago, and I remember asking him, what is it for you that makes a great soundtrack? And he mentioned melody, and Michael, not everybody goes for that, but you do.
Oh, I definitely do. I couldn't agree with him more, and he was clearly one of the absolute masters of doing that. You know, he wrote some of the most beautiful themes ever put on out in the world, and melody for me, it's a reflection of a story. When you sing the theme to Star Wars, or you hum Superman, or any of these things, you know, it really brings you back to the story that you were exposed to. And for me, listening to the soundtracks was, again, just another way to relive the film that I love so much, or relive the story that I wanted to hear again. You know, storytelling for me has always been a huge, huge thing. And I think, just like the greats did with opera, you were able to attach themes and leitmotifs to characters and situations, which helped tell that story. So, you know, Max Steiner was the very first to do it in King Kong for film. You know, he created a score like one that hadn't been done before at all like that. And yet he did it once. And then from then on, that's the model that everyone follows for the most part. You know, that idea of attaching melodies and themes to characters or situations so that the audience can be drawn deeper into the story that's being told. So I always loved that. Like when I hear Kong's theme, I get chills. When I, the same thing could be said about Darth Vader's theme. John Williams was amazing. Jerry Goldsmith was one of the best as well. All of these guys that I grew up with, that I loved, that I admired so much, they all had used this process of this idea of melody and storytelling. And it's really one of my favorite things to do.
But some of those names you have mentioned, you have had to literally follow in the footsteps of their work. I mean, you mentioned John Williams with, obviously, you know, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, Jurassic World before that, Lalo Schifrin with Mission Impossible 3, Jerry Goldsmith with Star Trek. How does that feel for you to sort of have to nod your head to the masters but bring your own sound to these new franchises, if you like?
You know, it's always an honor. I mean, I always feel incredibly like I have a great responsibility to these people that I grew up listening to. We're talking about, you know, like you mentioned, Jerry Goldsmith, John Williams, it's Lalo Schifrin, Alexander Courage. All of these guys I grew up worshiping, you know, really never ever thinking that I would have any sort of place in this history myself, and to be able to work, you know, use their material as a springboard to tell a story that I loved as a kid. You know, the Planet of the Apes series is a perfect example. I loved Planet of the Apes. I mean, I literally wanted to be an ape when I was a kid after seeing that for the first time. And I would follow my dad around at the supermarket walking like an ape, you know, when I was 8 years old, you know, just trying to perfect that Roddy McDowell walk that he did. And you know, I'm sure my dad was like, oh, I can't believe this kid is back here following me looking like this. But I was always in my mind somewhere else. I was always imagining something else. And it was really the music and the work that those guys had done that really helped get me there. So to be able to, you know, go all these years later and be a part of that is really, really just a huge honor, and also a real creative challenge. Because, as you said, you don't want to just rehash what was done. I want to sort of hint at what was done, but then take it somewhere else, somewhere new, or add to it in a way which feels like it's still part of that legacy that they began way back when.
To your incredibly successful collaboration with J.J. Abrams. On Lost in particular, I would imagine, firstly, it sounded to me that you had great artistic freedom, but also that ahead of your movie work, that TV is a great experience because of the very fast turnover, I understand.
Yeah, TV is one of the great teachers as far as when it comes to doing a score that's on a time schedule, you know, anything. You know, I think in any profession, you have to learn how to be organized and get things done on time if you're going to be successful at what you do. And television absolutely taught me how to do that. Starting with Alias, you know, you're talking about you would have 3 days to record, to write, orchestrate, and record about, you know, 35 minutes of music. And those shows were hour dramas, so they had a lot of music in them. I remember when they first started, I remember the first episode maybe had 17 minutes, and then the second one had maybe 20 minutes. It kept creeping up, and then it got to this like 30, 35 minute range that never let up. And it was just, you know, years of that. So I really look at that time in my life working in television as a boot camp for film scoring. So when it came time to do film scoring, I mean, you're dealing with much bigger budgets, much larger orchestras. So you have to really watch what you're doing and make sure you're organized and can deliver on time. No, the worst thing you can do is hem and haw and worry about a cue and rewrite. I because that just slows you down. So generally, television taught me just go with your gut, trust your instincts, and you can always fix it later if you have to.
When it came then to working on Star Trek initially with JJ, how much is discussed between the two of you? How much of a collaboration is it? Do you ever argue, or does he just go off you go, Michael? Tell us a little bit about this.
You know, it almost always starts with Michael, just go off and do what you think, you know, with him. And, you know, we do discuss the story. We discuss the characters. We discuss what the arc of the whole thing is, or the theme he wants to tell, you know, what's the idea behind it all. But the truth is, JJ has been an amazing collaborator in that he has given me so much freedom to do what I want to do. And it doesn't mean I get to do anything I want to do, because it's, again, as I said, it's a collaboration. So we need to work together. But we are always honest with each other. And if I do something that he feels isn't right, he can say that without fear of me being upset or me going, you know, oh man, I spent so much time on this. And I understand that's not what it's about. It's not about me. It's about this film that we have up on the screen in front of us. And we both want that to be as best it can be. So I am happy to listen to anything he has to say, and vice versa. He will listen to me as well. We have this great sort of relationship that has you know, kind of grown over the years, and it's a really a shorthand when it comes to working on these.
You seem to work with people, you know, like-minded people. I other guests on this show, indeed, were your pals Pete Docter and Jonas Rivera behind Up,
yeah,
and Inside Out. We spoke to them about Inside Out when they were here. They spoke very highly of you. You'll be glad to know.
Oh, they're so great. I love working with them.
Yeah, I mean, you really do. And then with Brad Bird, obviously, initially with The Incredibles. You know, anytime I play The Incredibles on this show, I always sort of describe it as a Bond-esque score. And
yes.
I would like to put it out there to you that you should score the next Bond movie. Would you be up for it?
Well, I don't know. In some ways, I feel like in doing The Incredibles, I've done that, you know, like and also been given the freedom to take it in a place where, you know, maybe I'd have different constraints within a Bond franchise. But here I was able to do Bond-ish, but also sort of bring in bits of Henry Mancini and Hoyt Curtin and John Barry and mix it all together. You know, I felt like with The Incredibles, I had this great freedom to not just only do what the Bond franchise has delivered over the years, but also bring in new ideas and new fun things from other areas of sort of orchestral jazz that I loved growing up.
And are you still working on Incredibles 2, or has that wrapped?
Oh, no, still working on it. Actually, I haven't even written a note for it yet. I'm about to. I'll probably start 1st of November working on that. I just finished Coco, so.
Okay. Well, tell us a bit about Coco and in terms of just the composing process on that for you.
Coco was an amazing experience. You know, growing up, my dad had this great record collection of all styles of music. I had a great uncle who owned an appliance store in Philadelphia, and you know, he would sell stereos, and RCA would send him these records, these demo records, you know, Dinah Groove and all of these great things that they used to do at the time to just, you know, to show how stereo works. So those albums that he would get for the store always inevitably ended up back at our house at some point. And so my dad had this great collection of all of this stuff. And I remember one of them was sort of, you know, and I don't know exactly what it was called. It was something like, you know, The Music of Mexico or something like that. And it gave this, and I used to listen to that album and I loved it. And I, from that point, I always loved Mexican music. It always was very beautiful. It was melodic. It was simple. It was peaceful. And it was fun. You know, there was so much about it. So I always loved it. So getting a chance to work on Coco and write in that idiom, for me, was something I've been wanting to do for a long time. But you always have to wait for the right project.
Yeah.
And this was perfect. And I also got to work with Mexican music specialists, you know, who... You know, where I imagined that Mexican music was this one thing, they taught me that it was so much more than that. And I learned so much about all styles of Mexican music, and I was able to delve into writing for all of those different styles for the film. And because we really truly wanted the film to feel like it was really taking place in Mexico, like you had visited Mexico once this film was over, you know, and not in a sort of commercial or just stereotypical way. We wanted to dig deep and get into the different styles and the different ways of using the instruments and the players. And we even went to Mexico to record many players for the score, which was just such a great experience.
Sounds great. I can't wait to see it and hear your score as well. We can't talk to you without talking about your Oscar award-winning score for Up, which any time I play it, I get such a warm response to it. Can we talk about, you know, Married Life, the gorgeous piece? And for people listening, they'll know it as the scene where we meet with the old man Carl as a boy, beginning to fall in love with Ellie. That this wordless 4-minute scene, we see a montage of Carl and Ellie's life together, ending with Ellie's illness and death. It's so emotional, but it struck me today, Michael, that you're one of the few people in the world to have seen that piece of animation without your music. And I wondered about your initial reaction to seeing it cold as such.
Well, I think my initial reaction was very much like everyone's reaction after seeing it completed, which was I had tears in my eyes. I cried, and it really, you know, it was one of those things. I almost, you know, when it was over, I wasn't even thinking about like the film itself. All I was thinking about is, wow, we are all going to go through that one point in our life. You know, everyone is going to lose somebody that means something to them. And that's universal, you know, and that's the takeaway. And it just made me really think about that and think about the people in my own life. So when it came down to writing that scene, it was less about what's happening on screen. It was more about just what happens to us all in life, you know, and that feeling, you know, it all started there. It's and I even when we did record it on the stage, I mean, I remember the first couple times we played it, like me, Jonas, and Pete were sitting there listening, and we're the three of us are crying, and you look around and you see everyone else in the booth crying too, and you're
you
just
can't
like
not crying,
you know,
just, yeah,
yeah. It Pete crafted such a wonderfully universal story, which you know was told in this really fanciful, fun, beautiful way, but at its core it's something that hits us all very deeply, because it speaks to this truth of the impermanence of life, the impermanence of relationships, and the idea that, you know, with this very short period of time you have on this planet, you need to try and experience the things and experience life in a way which helps you appreciate that small time we have here. So I think, you know, again, and Pete is one of the few people that could actually pull that off in the way that he did. He's a magician. If you ask me, he's not a director. He's a magician. He's incredible.
I just wanted to talk to you briefly about two of your more recent releases, because within a few weeks this summer, we had not one but two movies scored by you, Spider-Man Homecoming and War for the Planet of the Apes. War for the Planet of the Apes, I just loved your music for this. There was this very sort of the prologue, big sort of opening. But this particular track that I always come back to and the one I play is Exodus Wounds, which is such a beautiful, gentle theme that builds up to this orchestral theme with vocals. Can you tell us a little bit about creating it? Because it really stood out for me.
You know, I watched the film, and I usually will watch a movie and then kind of wander off and think about it for a day or two and just sort of absorb what it meant to me. And I remember watching that film and being, you know, I was devastated in many ways emotionally by the first movie that I worked on with Matt, which was Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And I was like thinking like, he can't do that again. That's not going to, you know, how does he top that? And when I watched this film, the overwhelming sense of loss and sort of confusion as to where is my life headed, all of these things that these characters are dealing with, it really hit me in a big way. And I remember coming right back to my studio and sitting at the piano, and that theme came out in minutes. It was like, it was almost as if I just sat down, started playing, and it was there waiting for me. And I didn't mess with it. I ran right back to my writing desk and just started writing it, putting it into the scene, seeing what's working. And it really, it was something that happened so quickly and so fast, but it was all based on this visceral sort of emotional reaction that I had to the story and the characters. And that's, for me, the thing I look for more than anything else when I'm going to do a film. Am I emotionally connected with it is number one. And will I enjoy working with the people that are making this film? That's number two. Those two things, if those answers aren't both yes, then I can't do the movie.
We've spoken about you following in the footsteps of many composers. When it came to Spider-Man Homecoming, again, this, you know, many composers have worked on scoring Spider-Man films. So first of all, I have to say, I love that you used the 1960s TV theme at the time.
Yeah.
It just felt great to hear it.
Well, that was really fun because, Kevin Feige, who runs Marvel, is such a wonderful guy and comes from the same place that I came from in terms of loving all of this when we grew up. And we were walking out to the parking lot one day at Disney, and he said, "What do you think of the old Spider-Man theme?" And I was like, "Oh my God, I love it." I said, "In fact, I've always wanted to just do a huge orchestral version of that. It would be so fun." And he's like, "Well, why don't we do one for when we announce Spider-Man at Comic-Con? Would you be up for doing that?" And I was like, "Yes." So we actually went to London. We recorded this big version of it for Comic-Con. That was the first time we did it. And so when the audience, you know, you're in this room with 8,000 people, Hall H at Comic-Con. It's like their big sort of reveal hall. And the music starts and it's all dark and they had just have these sort of lights starting to happen. And you could see the people going, "Wait, what is this? I know this. I know this." And as soon as sort of the melody starts, you start seeing this eruption of joyfulness throughout the entire hall. And it was amazing to see, like, just such love and joy come from the fact that this theme was being played, but in a huge, big way. So once we did that, we felt like, okay, we have to open the film with this as well, because it's, you know, and I just put it on top of my old, you know, because I had done the Marvel logo music as well for them. So we just took that out and we put in the Spider-Man theme, and it worked great. It just seemed like a really fun way to start the whole story.
Well, indeed, the next time you're going to see many, many, many of your fans erupt with happiness in a big hall will be in the Albert Hall on the 20th of October. A huge celebration of your music, Michael, celebrating is also a big birthday, your 50th birthday coming up. How much do you know about this concert? Because I know it's your sister who's organizing it. So are you in on it all or not?
I'm in it in the sense that I have to make sure the suites that we're playing are up to snuff and what they should be, and there's a lot of questions of that sort, you know, musical stuff. I don't know much about the layout of the concert or who's gonna be there or any of that, you know, like there's a lot of that. I know a lot of my friends are gonna come over for it, but I know only basically what I have to know, I guess the answer is. So
are you gonna conduct any of it?
Yeah, definitely. I you know, I'm looking at this list going, because originally it was supposed to be just me listening and my friend Ludwig conducting. And Ludwig is an amazing conductor. But as I'm going down the list, I'm like, I want to conduct that, or I want to conduct that one too. That's going to be too fun. I got to do that, you know. So, yeah, I will definitely be up there as well. I'm you know, as much as I can or as much as it makes sense to be. But, you know, having done a few concerts there at the Albert Hall, I mean, I'm so excited. It's literally like one of my favorite rooms to be in. It's such an impressive, incredible room, and just thinking of the history behind it all too just puts you into this great place.
And it's interesting too, because a lot of your fans now will actually hear your soundtracks before seeing a movie, and then, you know, going to your concerts again, just focusing on the music. How do you feel about, you know, the thought of people listening to your music before seeing the visuals, and again getting a different, if you like, appreciation of it?
You know, there's two schools of thought on that, because I know some fans like will buy the soundtrack but will not listen to it until they see the movie. And then the other camp will listen to it rabidly and then go and enjoy the movie as well. So I guess, you know, it depends on your level of tolerance for spoilers, you know, things like that. You know, do you want, you know, for me, I personally love to go see a movie without knowing anything about it, not having heard any of the music, not, you know, knowing as little as possible. Because I love that experience of having a story unfolded before your eyes, you know, that, you know, and I feel like if you go in too much, if you're knowing too much, it sort of ruins that experience, you know? So for me, my vote would be, don't listen to anything. Don't look at anything. Just go see it and have fun experiencing the story being told to you.
Okay. Well, there's going to be a great night of your music in the Royal Albert Hall on October the 20th. You do realize that it's a very short flight then to Dublin. When are you going to come and visit us here, Michael?
You know what? Well, I know. I want to do that. And my mom has been pestering me, go to Ireland. Go, 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 because you will love it. And I know I will. And my life has been so, like, sort of crazy with all of these projects, one after the other, and I'm now starting to find time to carve out to go and do the things that I want to do. And one of the things I really want to do is come to Dublin and do a Lost concert. I know there are a lot of Lost fans there, and I think it would be just such a great place to do it. So hopefully that will get on the schedule sometime in the near future.
That'd be good. Well, I am officially extending the invitation, so there you go.
Sounds great.
Thank you so much for your time today, Michael. A very happy birthday to you, Michael, from all your fans here in Ireland. And thank you for the wonderful music creations in film you have given us, and continued success to you.
Oh, thank you so much. You're so welcome. Thanks for having me. It was great talking to you.
On digital, satellite and online, 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM, where life sounds better.